Stay tuned for The Turning Point with Mike Fader. I don't know how it feels to be free. I don't know how it feels to be a bird in the sky. I would like to. I certainly would like to. That would be great. Today, I have to say that I have a subject that I want to talk about. Not so much I want to talk about, that it wants to talk about itself. But I'm kind of sad and scared, actually, to talk about it. I have a tremendous reluctance to talk about it because it's so... Because for two reasons. One is because it was such an overwhelming experience, and the experience has not gone away. It's not, I used to tell stories on the air years ago, actually for a long time, for decades, and there were stories about things that had happened to me years before, sometimes decades before the telling of the story, the time of the telling of the story. But, and so I was able to look back on these events, some of them horrific, disastrous, extreme in one way or another, with a kind of objective, distance. But what I need to talk about today is something that's still happening to me. And therefore, it is very difficult. In fact, it's closer to almost impossible to achieve an objective point of view. This morning, on the way down, actually, while I was sitting in my apartment before I came down here, I heard a siren. It was probably an ambulance. Why was it an ambulance? It could have been. Well, you can tell the difference after a while between an ambulance and a police car and fire engine, of course. But I heard the ambulance, and it reminded me of what I needed to talk about today, and it reminded me of what anniversary it is today. Today, not that I needed reminding, by the way, not that I needed reminding, because as I said before, I know, when is he going to get to the point? I don't know. Maybe I'll never get to the point. Maybe I'll just stop. This is a tough one. I mean, even though I've talked about all kinds of tough things before, it reminded me of what today is and what I was going to talk about. Today is the 1 year anniversary of the moment almost exactly a year ago when I almost died from a heart attack. And it wasn't just a heart attack. It was basically what they call an aortic dissection, which is a fancy way of saying that the aorta part of your heart just splits open. And what happened was I was walking. Here's where it gets difficult, because as I say, it's not like it just happened. It's not like it happened a year ago and I'm, you know, I've gone through all the four stages of grief and anger, acceptance, denial, whatever, you know, in whatever order. But I feel like it's just happening right now. What happened was, I'm walking along in Riverside Park with my wife on a Sunday morning. Last year, December 8th was on a Sunday. And suddenly felt this, my legs turned to rubber. I fell down and I felt this hollow sinking feeling inside me, as if suddenly there was nothing inside my chest at all. It wasn't painful. Wasn't painful, and I had no history of heart attacks to measure anything by, and I had never had any kind of trouble particularly with my heart before, but I could tell immediately it was something had to do with my heart. It wasn't as if it hurt, like I say. It was basically as if somebody had snatched it out of my chest, like it wasn't there anymore. It wasn't working. And actually, it wasn't working. And by pure luck, I suppose, I guess you could call it luck, although subsequent events leading up to even today, how I feel, sometimes I wonder whether it was luck, but out of pure luck, my wife and I don't have cell phones that we carry around. Maybe we should, but we don't. I have a cheap one that I carry around during the week sometimes, but not on a weekend. And this is on a weekend walking in Riverside Park, which is on the western side of Manhattan, and where people sometimes promenade. And it was cold. Yeah, it was cold, but it wasn't that cold. And what happened was that my wife got terrified, of course, and found somebody, since most people carry cell phones, found somebody with a cell phone, and the person with the cell phone called up the local hospital, a big hospital because it's Manhattan, St. Luke's Hospital. Originally, I guess when they found it, it was maybe a Catholic hospital, but now St. Luke's is owned by some, you know, multinational corporation, maybe Sony, Microsoft, maybe Amazon owns St. Luke's. I have no idea. Don't they own everything else? So they called the hospital, and the hospital sent an ambulance over. Meanwhile, I'm lying there. It didn't hurt. It didn't hurt. But I knew that something terrible had happened. So I'm just lying there because I couldn't move. And I hear the siren coming. I hear the siren. Now, all of this is what I saw, what I felt. Everything is absolutely crystal clear in my head. In fact, it's too crystal clear. It's as if it just happened, or it's just happening. So even though a year has gone by, I can't say I've moved on. And people encourage you. You know, ever you go to a doctor, you go to a cardiologist. Everything from the cardiologist to the psychiatrist, they tell you, well, you know, you've got to try to move on from this, move on from this. Well, I'm not a big mover-oner. And that's my problem. It's my problem. And I can only hope that, as always, I say this as always when I'm talking to people, there might be some people out there who share some of my feelings about the world, or the way I see the world, or the way I think about the world, because otherwise, what's the point? I mean, I'm not coming on here for free psychoanalysis. I have feel like I have a responsibility to connect with all of you who are listening. And if some of you can't connect to this, well, then you could connect to the show I did last week on Bill Cosby and hidden identities and masks that people wear. Or you can connect to whatever the show is that will come next week. God providing that there is a show next week, or somebody providing that there is a show next week. So, you know, if this one, you know, it's all hit or miss. But I like to think that what I'm talking about, somewhere along the line, someplace, part of it will touch something that that somebody listening feels or thinks, or some experience that you had. So they, I hear the siren, then I see the, and I hear my wife in the distance, and I see her out of the corner of my eye, terrified, of course, having no idea what's going to happen or what is happening, and you know, just that horrible, helpless feeling when somebody is stricken. And this has happened to me. Maybe it's happened to you too. Somebody is suddenly stricken or gets very sick next to you. Almost maybe you feel like it's fatal. It's happened to me with my wife, and she had a potentially fatal illness once, and I had to rush her to the hospital. And it's happened to me with other people in my life, maybe more than the average person. You know, that's just where where karma placed me. I was, in the presence of people who had been recently shot, or people who had convulsions, epileptic fits, things like that. It seems to me that I have been provided with these opportunities to try to, to help people. And I did at those times. Anyhow, so I remember all this. I remember my wife crying in that helpless, awful way. And I remember and I heard the sound of the siren. I heard it coming. And I didn't feel like cavalry to the rescue. I was just feeling too sick and overwhelmed and scared to death. But I did hear the siren. And it's a sound that I can't forget. And one reason I can't forget it is because it's burned into my memory for that day. Aside from the fact that it happened right then and there to me, is that I live, as I've mentioned before here on this show, I live just a few blocks from St. Luke's Hospital. And I hear sirens, and some of and I live also just a few blocks from the local police station and from the local fire station. And I hear sirens all day long, and I hear them all the time. But in the city, you get used to that kind of thing. You get used to the hearing sirens, but you hear more of them if you live next to these places. And I hear sirens all day long. And every time I hear a goddamn siren, and this is one of the things that happens in the city. When you hear a siren, the first thing you think is, oh, you know, somebody's been. You don't think about the cops too often. I mean, unless of course. You do think about the cops if you're in that line of business, or if you live in a neighborhood. But the neighborhood I live in, you don't have emergency visits by cops all that much. Not that much crime in my neighborhood, my immediate neighborhood anyhow. But you do think of fire, and you wonder, could it be my building? You know, God forbid. Or you think, is it an ambulance on its way? And is it in somebody in my building? So the first thing you think of is fire. And then if the siren fades away, you could continue to think, oh, God, this is terrible. Somebody's, place is burning. I mean, I hope they're all right. But you also think, and this is typical of what happens in the city, you also think, whew, it's not coming to my building. It's not coming to my building. So there's no fire in my building. It's what you think. And the sirens, same thing as the sirens for the ambulances. The ambulance, and you hear them all day long. And I wish I lived in a different place, but we don't have the ability, for various reasons, to move from where we live right now. It has to do with my wife's job and connections I have. And it's just impossible to move. But it would be nice not to hear these sirens all day long. I mean, you know, hear them. It's not like I live right next door to the hospital, but close enough. So all day long, I hear these sirens. And every time I hear the siren, it means something different to me now than it did before that day when I had the heart attack. I call it a heart attack, whatever it was. And the siren reminds me. The siren reminds me. It's like it opens the stitches of the operation I eventually had to have. I can't get that siren sound out of my bones, out of my brain, out of my body memory. So, and I hear them all day long, and it's very hard to ignore them because they're loud. So what happened to me is they rushed me to the hospital, and I could hear, I think I heard one of the EMT guys say that, I'm going to have a little water, my throat is really scratchy this morning. Sorry, I apologize about that. Sorry. So they rush me, and I hear one of the EMT guys say something about heart, and I think some other thing about like rupture or split. All sounds pretty bad. But meanwhile, I'm just in I'm in a kind of shock, you know. I mean, they're loading me in. I don't know what's going to happen to me. I don't know if this has ever happened to you, and I hope it hasn't happened, and maybe it never, and that it never will. Is that being loaded into an ambulance? Has that ever happened to you? Well, I hope it never does happen to you because, you know, you're so completely helpless. I mean, they load you in, you're stricken with something, or else you wouldn't be loaded in the first place. And they take me to the hospital, and which is only about 10 blocks away. Sorry. Later on, they told me that if I had been 15 or 20 blocks away from the hospital, I wouldn't have lived. That I was close enough to the hospital where they were able to rush me in. And yet I don't know about that because when I was, the next thing I remember after they took me out of the ambulance, and I remember them taking me out of the ambulance, I must have passed out though because I don't remember them taking me out actually. And I wake up and I'm in an emergency room and there's a doctor leaning over me, a woman doctor, and then there's my wife with that horrible anxious look on her face. And the doctor says to me, you have had... she says it in you know, medical terms, and then she says, "You know, you have a split in your aorta and serious internal bleeding. If we don't operate on you immediately, this moment, you will die." Whew. Die? Me? Me? Right? Me? Actually, the Mike Fader die right there. Nobody has ever said that to me before. I did I take it seriously? I mean, you know, I've seen that in a lot of movies. I've read about it in a lot of books. I see it on TV shows. You know, I watch a lot of cop dramas, and I've seen a lot of violent movies. You know, you're going to die. If you don't do this, you're going to die. If you don't hand over the ransom money, if you don't undergo this operation, yeah, okay. But she was a real doctor, and she's saying it to me. Now, at any given time, I don't have the best grip on reality. But here, I'm in complete shock. And maybe it's part of a natural distancing that that you do. I mean, I'm not, like I say, I'm not so tuned into reality, unfortunately, to begin with. And I tend to fantasize or to place myself in dramatic situations, which aren't always exactly what's going on in my life. A way of keeping distance from things so that I don't feel overwhelmed by people or by experiences. So she said, you're going to die. And I don't think I really believed her, but she was very earnest. She really meant it. And I look at her and I look at my wife, and it's not the first time in my life that the word die has occurred to me. Now, this is why it's difficult to talk about this, why I said earlier why it's hard for me to talk about this, because I may have to say some things that people might find really hard to take. I have thought about dying before in my life, but not because I was, once or twice I was pretty sick and was rushed to an emergency room, but it wasn't a fatal situation. It was just tremendous pain that I was in, and the situation was resolved on an outpatient basis. But the sad truth is that often in my life, since I was a little kid, I've had periods where I wished I was dead and I wished I and I would wanted to and I wanted to die. I guess to be blunt about it, by my own hand, you know. But here's somebody telling me on the outside. Now, maybe that's where I was being dishonest with myself for a long time. I mean, I still feel that some from time to time that I have that feeling. And I felt that way since I was like 4 years old, that I felt like just drifting off into some other place and some, you know, maybe imagine there was a heaven or some beautiful other parallel universe, at least that I would be out of whatever psychic or emotional or physical pain I was in. Usually psychic or emotional. But this is somebody else. This is a doctor looking down at me, and this is real life. And she said, if you don't have this operation right now, you're going to die. Now, I guess she was asking my permission. She was asking my permission. Why they don't just rush you to the emergency room and operate on you to keep you from dying, it's a mystery to me why they didn't do that. But somehow, after they had examined me, and I wasn't awake for that. I guess I had blacked out, or, you know, I had just distanced myself so much I didn't remember it. Then she said that to me. And could I have said no at that point? But I looked at my wife, and I thought of my kids, and I thought, no, I probably don't want to die. I probably don't want to die. It wasn't no, of course not. Operate immediately. No, sad to say, I had to mull it over for a second because I've had a hard, long life. And I'm thinking to myself, geez, what is this going to be now? You know, who knows what I'm going to go through here? And yet she says, we're going to operate on you immediately. If we don't, you'll die. So I say, okay, then do it. But I had the thought in my mind, not forefront, not in the center, you know, like totally conscious, but I had the idea in my mind that she would operate on me the way I've had operations before. You know, I've had hernia operations, and I've had all kinds of ambulatory procedures. And my conception of we're going to have to operate on you is they operate on you, then they sew you up, and then later on, or the next day, they discharge you from the hospital, and you go home, and you take some painkillers for a few days, and then maybe it takes a while to get back into shape, maybe a couple of weeks, you know, and then you feel better. That's not what happened. That is not what happened. But I was under the impression, you know, for some reason, or maybe because I wanted to believe it, that that's what would happen. So what has ensued over this period was went into a coma. For a couple of days, they put me on a heart-lung machine and did emergency open-heart surgery, where they, and like I told you before, if you don't want to listen to the rest of this, tune away and rejoin us whenever this show is over for preparing vegetables in the best way or whatever, you know, or the latest and and political travesty and outrage, whatever it is that PRN, I'm making fun of PRN, but in fact, I think this is a great station. So whatever show is on after me, you can tune away and rejoin us for that show. But what they do when they do open heart surgery is they literally saw open your chest. They crack it open. They pull it open. They crack it. I mean, I don't even know exactly, but they, you know, they smack it with some hard implements. They saw a bit. And they just crack it open like you're a lobster. And they pull apart the ribs in front of your heart. And then I was put on a heart-lung machine. I have an idea what a heart-lung machine might look like, although I've never seen one. And I don't ever want to see one. But I was on one because they put all kinds of tubes down your throat. And you can't breathe on your own when you're doing this. And your heart is not beating on its own. So they hook you up to a machine that that beats your heart for you, that actually turns into your heart. A machine becomes your heart. And this was for 8 hours. 8 hours. Not that I knew about this, because I was gone. I was gone. I mean, they gave me anesthetic, obviously, and they kept giving me anesthetic, knocked me out, and later on put me into a coma. I think they induced a coma, or I went into a coma, so you don't feel the shock and the pain of it until you pull out of it. But the machine breathes for you. It takes the place of your lungs. It takes the place of your heart. And often bad things happen on a heart-lung machine. People have been known to have brain damage on a heart-lung machine. It has affected their eyesight. Sometimes has harmed their eyesight, or it has harmed other organs in your body. I mean, it's a severe thing when a machine like that is hooked up to you. Anyhow, I woke up in intensive care about 2 or 3 days later. I don't really know. On a lot of painkillers and hooked up to all kinds of things, catheters and tubes and everything coming in and out of me in different ways. All kinds of, and then I started having hallucinations, because one of the wonderful blessings of the heart-lung machine is, and you see, this is part of it here. Do I sound ungrateful for the fact that they saved my life? Do I sound ungrateful? Well, that's only because I am partially. It's terrible, but it's true. It's true. It's not like I've always had this burning enthusiasm and love for life. I grew up in a way, which I've been over, you know, countless times ad nauseum, that did not recommend life to me. You know, that the idea of getting up each morning and seeing mom and dad and going out to school and being with the guys and my friends and being with all my, you know, and then, you know, looking forward to things and outings and camp and weekends. And I didn't have that kind of life. So, you know, and I lived, you know, right next door to a cemetery, which I spent my entire childhood staring at day and night because it was nothing else. That's what you saw when you looked out the window. So life was for me always, I always had one foot and an arm and half my brain and about half the rest of my body in another world. So she says, you want to live? You know, you're going to die. I said, okay, let's do it. Let's, you know. But I really was under the impression that it was going to be a simple thing. No, it wasn't a simple thing. I lay in that hospital bed in an excruciating position because I couldn't turn on my side. It was impossible to turn on my side because my ribs were wired together and they were just healing. And my heart was healing, but especially my ribs. If I turn on my side, I would get tremendous pain in my chest from the wires and the sutures and everything else. And everything was cracked. It had to grow. The bones had to grow back together. Is this entertaining you? You having a snack right now or anything? Well, that's not my responsibility, is it? And that's your responsibility as a grown person. I assume there's one or two grown people who listen to me. So, 30? Did you say? Okay. I get countdowns like I'm a rocket ship about to take off. And I need it because I can't really judge from various clocks that we have around here. So I lay in there in terrible pain, and I couldn't speak. I couldn't speak like this because of all the tubes they put down my throat for 8 hours. My vocal cords also, they managed to, while they were operating on me, and this is part of the problem, which I still have, is your left vocal cord, and I mean everybody's left vocal cord, for some bizarre reason, only, you know, God herself knows why, your left vocal cord is looped in a funny way around or near your heart. So while they were operating on my heart, they managed to snip one of my vocal cords with their scissors or whatever it is that they were doing. And my voice has never been the same and will never be the same again. I used to have a pretty strong, expressive voice, which I can still have from time to time, but it gets much more tired, easier, and sometimes it just sounds like a croaking frog. And I have to do voice exercises all the time, and it doesn't always work. And I take various drugs which dry out my throat, which doesn't help either. So They did this, and I wasn't able to speak. I was appalled by that. The pain was awful. And then I woke up, and there's all my, you know, there's my wife, and there's there's the kids, and everybody's there, and you know, the kids had flown in from different places where they live, and from that time on, it's been rough. And basically, what that did was it erased my life. This heart attack, this heart incident erased my life. I couldn't talk very well for several months, and I had other radio shows that I did besides this one, two other radio shows, and I got paid to do one of them on satellite radio. I had a pretty well-developed hobby, which was turning into something of a profession where I went all over the city and took pictures. And I had a life, and I was finally, up until the time of this heart incident, I was getting my life together after 68 years. It took that long for me to get my life together. And since that has happened, my whole life was erased. I couldn't do any radio shows. So I started doing this one again only this past June. It took 6 months for me to start doing this radio show because out of sheer fear and because my voice was so messed up. And while I'm in the hospital, it was such a shock to me that it brought back every nasty, vicious little demon that lived inside me, which had taken me many, many years and many times of being in a dark hole to overcome. Fear, rage, urgency, hypervigilance, all these things, and essentially retreating from life. Retreating from life and just being scared about everything. And it just all came out again, like it was just sitting there waiting for the top to be lifted off. And when they cracked open my chest and when this all went on and when I couldn't speak, that's what happened. At one point, a psychiatrist came in and he asked me, you know, how do I feel? Because they're not going to check you out of the hospital. This is closer to the time when physically I was getting better. He said, how do you feel? And they don't check you out if you're completely loony. And I did have terrible hallucinations from the heart-lung machine and from some of the medicine they gave me. Really scary hallucinations. I mean, I couldn't even begin to describe them or the terror of these hallucinations. And they were... and I had hallucinations before in my life, but these were caused by chemicals and by the heart-lung machine and stuff they were giving me. And he said, what is it that that you would want the most now that you've had, you know, you almost died? When you're discharged from here, what are you going to do? What are you going to do with your life now? What do you want? And I said in my raspy voice, I could hardly speak. I said, I want to get rid of the desperation that I've always felt. I want to drop this desperate feeling. I have always felt night and day, even though I managed to have a couple of periods of maybe a year or two here and there, where I felt relaxed, where I felt at ease being alive and with other people. But other people have always scared me. Responsibility, situations, life itself has always been challenging and even frightening to me. And I'm always always walking around in a state of fear, and if not fear, rage. And it puts you into a state of desperation. And I said to that, I croaked to this doctor. It was an Indian doctor. And I thought he might understand this, right? Somehow I got the idea, I don't know why, that he was originally maybe a Hindu, because he had a thick accent and he came from India. And maybe he would understand what I was talking about. I said, I want to let go of this. I want to let go of this desperation. And that's my great wish. And it was a kind of epiphany to me that I wanted to let go of this desperation, that I lived my life in a desperate state, and I wanted to just let it go. I wanted to let it go. Just let it be, you know? Leave it alone. Let it be. The rage, the anger, the stuff left over from my childhood, the hypervigilance, the nuttiness, the fear. Just let it be. Let it go. And I can't say that that's happened. I mean, a lot of people, you know, would say that when something like this happens to you. In fact, I had a friend who's actually stopped talking to me, one of my best friends, probably my best friend, stopped talking to me because he had a similar experience once where he fell apart and then he got himself together. And he's always sort of been together since then, since his early 40s. And he called me up about a month after I had this operation and this tragic, horrible incident. And he was talking to me on the phone and he said, how you doing? And I told him, and he said, and he got really angry at me because I told him a couple of things that I was feeling and things I was doing. And he said, Jesus Christ, man, what is it ever going to take for you to change? You almost died. In other words, he thought I hit bottom. I have not hit bottom. Some people hit bottom, you know, drug addicts, people who almost die in accidents, they see their lives differently and they change. But I think that has to do with what of the nature of the person that it happens to. That's what I think. I know some people who have been to Vietnam and back, and I've read stories about people who have been to Vietnam and back. The people who come back more screwed up, the people who come back and their lives are never the same in a bad way, and they can't ever get it together. And there are people like that who went to Vietnam and saw some of the worst fighting. It's not just what they saw there and what happened there, which is horrible beyond words. It's what they brought with them over there. I think what you take out of one of these horrible experiences is what you bring to it. And what I was bringing to this experience was a lifetime of refusing to change, of fear and of anger. And it wasn't enough. I didn't really hit bottom. And sometimes I think there is no bottom for me to hit. I just keep going down a lot. And since that time, it's been crazy. I mean, I've gotten very depressed, which I'm going to talk about in a little while. But I had this epiphany. I said to the guy, I just want to not be desperate anymore. And I hope to myself, I hope that was true, that I wouldn't be desperate anymore. When I got home, that I could let that go. Because what could be more desperate than what happened to me? And I was watching a TV show a couple of months ago, and there was this alcoholic who had screwed up so bad that he had ruined his life so bad, and he had offended people and caused other people pain and misery, and he had embarrassed himself and humiliated himself and lost his job. And he went to a priest, and he got this alcoholic, revelation. He got this epiphany. He said, if only I could. And the priest said to him, he said, beware of epiphanies. Beware of epiphanies. Just because something happens to you that's extreme and you see what could very well be the truth of what your life should be, it doesn't mean that that's so simple that it happens that way. You have to work at it. You have to work at it. And I remember I had a friend, Billy, in college. And Billy was, he was a rich kid. He was originally from South America, but his family moved to New York, and they had a chain of stores. I forget what they were. I think they were, they rented tuxedos or something like that, a chain of stores. And Billy had an accent, and he was a very, very smart kid, and he was a friend of mine, about 20 years old, but he was dissolute. He was dissolute. He would wake up in the morning, he would drink all the time, let himself go completely. He had enough money so that he didn't have to wash his clothes. He just bought new clothes and just grabbed them off a rack and wore them every day. He threw out his clothes instead of washing any of them. And he would get up in the morning. He had a, is there a bigger than a quart size of Pepsi or Coke? He had the biggest bottle of Coke or Pepsi, and he kept it at his nightstand on the side. And he would just wake up in the morning and take a gigantic slug of Coke. That's what he did when he woke up. And he would drink all the time, and maybe he was taking drugs. I wouldn't know. I was too much of a square to recognize people taking drugs. And I said, Billy, man, why do you do this? You know, I was so upset about it because he was my friend. And he said, Mike, he said, I said, you're going to die. You keep this up. He says, Mike, death is just nature's way of telling us to slow down. I said, man, talk about hidden desperation.
Thank you.
don't know if you've ever had this experience, but I tell you, there's nothing like listening to music on headphones inside of a radio studio. I mean, you could listen to you can listen to music on headphones, super headphones, you know, on your home set or maybe some device that you carry around. And I'm sure it's a terrific experience, and I've done that myself. But there's something about listening to music inside a radio studio. I don't know what it is. There's some added something to it, some added juice to it. So since that time, since the whole structure of my life was erased, the only thing I have done creatively, and this is all just my problem, you know, since I went back to a time almost like my childhood where I was scared of everything and I was frightened. Every day I walk outside, as soon as I walk out the front door of my apartment building, I get scared. And I'm very psychosomatic, and I get dizzy. I feel like I'm going to fall over, and I feel like I'm going to have a heart attack any second. I have not gotten over that moment, and I've spent a lot of time inside by myself in isolation because I don't have the structure I used to have. I had two shows down here, and I'm hoping to develop a new show down here, which would be, if it does materialize, would be an interview show. And it wouldn't be interviewing people like I did on Sirius, the heads of think tanks or famous people or people, authors who wrote, brand new books on politics or history or culture. It would be, just be interesting people that I know or that other people know. I mean, if you're interesting, you know, when I announce this, you could apply for the job of being an interviewee. But it's people who have had really, really interesting lives, not necessarily famous people, some of them may be. But interesting lives and who are articulate and who would be maybe inspirational or at least funny or entertaining to listen to. So if I do that, I don't know. But since that time, I spent a lot of time in isolation. I didn't have my radio shows, didn't have anything. And I had lots of illnesses that were stirred up, like physical illnesses stirred up by this by this heart thing. And I got more and more and more anxious and depressed, and finally fell into a tremendous major depression, which I have to confess I am still in. And one of the things I do to struggle against it is to come down here and do this show every Monday. But until I start doing more, until I start seeing more people, and still I start doing more creative work, and maybe probably for me that means an extra radio show or even more than one extra radio show, I'm still in this really bad place. I'm still scared of things. I'm still anxious. I have trouble sleeping. And I am in a serious, serious depression, you know, hospital-grade depression, for which, unfortunately, I take many different pills, which also make you, for God's sake, sick. And they affect your voice. They dry you out. They dry you out. They dry out your eyes, so they make it hard to see. They dry out your vocal cords. They affect your bladder. They affect this. They affect that. They affect a million things, all these drugs. And they don't even help me that much. So I'm trying to reduce them. So this is where I'm at. But since I haven't hit bottom and since I haven't turned around and haven't had a revelation, seen the light, and let go of my desperation, but seem to be holding on to it even more all the time, although I don't necessarily sound that way on the air, because here I feel, like I mentioned before, a certain responsibility to connect to people and maybe not to sound as negative as I do and as desperate as I do most other places in my life. Pity the people who have to live with me or who know me. But what has changed? Has anything changed? Has anything changed over this time? One thing I realized was that when I was talking about this desperation earlier, it's a kind of control. Because I feel desperate all the time and always have felt desperate, I always feel like I have to have complete control over everything. I mean, absolute complete control. Like as if when I'm walking on the street, then I know where everybody is. And I could get, if I had total control, I would get everybody to shut up. I like quiet. I really like quiet because there's so much noise in my head all the time. Imagine if you had three different radio stations and two TVs on and a video game playing in your head all at the same time and you couldn't turn them off. this is often how it feels for me. And sleeping, good luck sleeping when you're like that, because it never shuts off. The minute I get up, let's say to use the bathroom in the middle of the night, bang, you know, it all starts again. And I suppose if I didn't take some of the pills I take, I wouldn't even be able to get back to sleep. And I don't sleep that well as it is. And you wake up often sweating, nervous, you have nightmares. This is not just because of what happened to me a year ago, the anniversary of this heart thing. I've had this most of my life. And so here I am. Before my life, I've taken a lot of these pills, too. And they are really, as Gary can easily tell you, as Gary Null can easily tell you, and as he's told me, of course, they are almost like poisonous. I mean, they can do you more harm than good. I know that, but I've tried natural things too, and I try that still, and I try to reduce the amount of drugs I take, but still they do have really bad side effects. And what I realize is that I do realize this, but it's intellectual. So have I changed at all since this, since this tremendously extreme life-threatening experience? Has anything changed at all in me? Here I am holding on, still desperate. In The Snow Leopard by Peter Matheson, if you've never read that book, give it a shot. It's one of the most moving, inspiring books, although sometimes it's a little tedious because it's about a subject that's very scientific. And if you're not scientific, well, I shouldn't say scientific, but it's kind of archaeological in a way and kind of about exploring other lands. I can't explain why, but it could be a little tough, a little tedious. But it is certainly one of the most moving, one of the most emotional, and one of the most possibly, if you're in the mood for it, transcendent books that you could ever read, The Snow Leopard by Peter Matheson. And part of what happens in The Snow Leopard is, or most of what happens is, he goes into the high, I think it's the Himalayas, tremendous high peaks in with snow and ice. And then he and a man who is a professional zoologist, I guess. I don't know what the word for it is. They're looking for they're looking for the snow leopard, which you hardly ever see. Hardly anybody ever sees a snow leopard. And they're in Nepal. And they're hot. They're like 20,000 feet up or 18,000 feet up. And there are the porters are helping them too. And these people are all Buddhists. And Peter Matheson also, most of his life, was a practicing Buddhist. And I'm not going to give you the plot of the book. But they're going around these mountain passes, you know, they're slippery, there's snow, there's ice, howling winds, and the path is about, I don't know, 2 feet, 3 feet, 4 feet at the most, right around this mountain. And if you fell, you would fall thousands of feet. And the porters were used to doing this. He was scared to death until he figured out what they were doing. And he explains this in Buddhist terms. And he explains that they never fell. These guys never fell. Although sometimes people they were guiding, Westerners, fell to their death. And very rarely did these people ever fall. And they walked as if they were walking down a sidewalk. No problems. They were smiling. And they walked, you know, they were careful, but they walked like they were walking down a sidewalk. Like there wasn't 8,000 feet off to their right where they were just going to die if they took a wrong step. And he said they had a phrase, and it was a Buddhist phrase, and it was called the people that died, that fell, they died because they fell because they were holding on too tight to the mountain. I always loved that phrase, holding on too tight to the mountain. In other words, trying to control everything. Their fear and their desperation controlled them rather than their understanding of the interchangeability of life and death, the change that occurs. They weren't in balance in themselves or in balance with the world and balanced with the idea of life and death. And it was called holding on too tight to the mountain. And certainly that's where I was most of my life, and that's where I am, unfortunately, right now. It's holding on too tight to the mountain. So it's control. I always feel like I have to control every situation, and I try and try and try in various ways to just let things go. to let the old fear and the old anger and the old feeling of vengeance. Because, for instance, here's a typical example. I take this personally. This heart, split aorta I had turns out to be, according to the doctors, a purely genetic thing. It just happens one out of, I don't know, many thousands of usually men it happens to. And it could happen when you're in your 40s or 50s or 60s or whatever. But I take it personally because I still feel, because of the way I grew up, that I am, there's something really almost like evil about me. And I could explain that, but I have explained it many times before. But I was given the impression, put it that way, over and over again, every day when I was growing up, that there was something almost like cursed or evil about me. I feel like this is personal. I take this personal. You know, I always think of Sonny Corleone, you know, in The Godfather. He says, this is just business. He says, and he's taking it personal. I take it personal, and I shouldn't. I shouldn't. It's absurd. It's completely irrational. But I feel like I'm being punished. I feel like I was being punished by having this heart condition. And I feel as if this depression that I'm struggling with all the time is also a personal attack on me by some entity, some force, some supernatural, you know, conglomeration of forces that are out to get me. It would be a good idea to lose that narcissism. That is holding on too tight to the mountain. The idea of controlling other people is holding on too tight to the mountain. But what has changed to me is what has changed, and what I hope will change, and what I already, like I mentioned before, you bring into these things, what you take out of these things, these events or these experiences, what you bring into them. So I brought all this desperation and urgency and control and fear and rage into this operation, into the last year. And what I'm bringing out of it is somewhat the same thing. But what I hope will change, and I think I'm already headed that way a little bit, and it comes and goes, is an understanding of the incredible fragility of life, which I think people sometimes understand instinctively. And when you get older, you see your parents die, maybe you see your friends die, and sometimes things happen suddenly. You understand that life is like that. It could just disappear in a second, like it almost did for me, that life is a very fragile, fragile thing. And also, I should understand aging and loss. And I'm trying to understand that because, you know, now I'm going to be 70 years old in June, hoping there's a June to come. But I think what's happening that may be positive is, and I'm working hard at this, is that I've always been extremely judgmental and critical of other people. And that's part of my own insecurity. What I hope to have happen, and this was happening before this heart attack, and I hope it happens again because I was well on my way to doing this, is I feel like I want to lose all my judgment of other people. I don't care who they are. I don't care how bad they are. Everybody's got their story. Now, I'm not going to excuse it or give people a free ride to be, you know, butchers or tyrants or lunatics that hurt other people. But still, I don't want to criticize anybody anymore. I want to drop all that. And also, if I had any concerns about, I'm watching a show about transvestites and transsexuals. I used to feel like, oh man, that's so creepy. That is so creepy and so weird, you know? Homosexuality. I mean, I grew up in the 50s, right? How do you lose what you grew up with? I don't care anymore. It doesn't make any difference to me anymore. This experience has told me that what's the difference? That love is love. It doesn't matter who, what, where, or how. And religion, I've always felt this way. Who cares? You know, who cares? Allah, Muhammad, Moses, Yahweh, Christ, God Almighty, Jehovah. It's all the same thing. It's either nothing, it's all the same thing. I don't care. It's all the same to me. Worship who you want. Just leave everybody else alone. Be what you are. Just leave everybody else alone. Don't preach to people. Don't preach to people. But I think the toughest thing for me is other people. I've always been scared, for reasons that I mentioned many times before, I've always been scared of other people. And What I've got to figure out is am I good enough just to be me? Do I have to have something that I do every day that, now you have to do something that's useful in the world, but is it good enough just to be me? I don't know. I hope to find out that it is. Meanwhile, there's really nothing I can do. I mean, Sartre said other people are hell, but that was his own melancholy, you know, his own problem. But meanwhile, the only thing I can do in the midst of all this, and this is a report that goes on and on and on, is I can try to be kinder than I am, and I can lean towards the light.
When I find myself in times of trouble, Mother Mary comes to me, speaking words of wisdom, let it be. And in my hour of darkness, she is standing right in front of me, speaking words of wisdom, let it be. Let it be, let it be, let it be, let it be. Whisper words of wisdom, let it be. And when the broken-hearted people living in the world agree, there will be an answer, let it be. For though they may be parted, there is still a chance that they will see, there will be an answer, let it be.